Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome back to What That Aged Well. This week is going to be a fun episode because we are joined in a bandwagon. We're going to rant about the Napoleon movie. And I know in the part three, I made a three-parter leading up to the movie about Napoleon, when the Napoleon movie released, which you should absolutely check out. But I thought the movie was good with my interview with Alexander Mikhail Berdsev. Sorry for saying his name wrong, but I saw the movie again recently, and having watched other reviewers as well, I have to take it back. It's a disastrous movie, and we're going to get more in detail on this, of course, but I want to begin with asking, how the hell do you screw up a movie about the life of Napoleon? How you don't have to add fictionalized. His life is stranger than fiction itself. You don't have to add things that never happened. His life is so exciting. And we don't talk about the Ridley Scott interview as well, where he mentioned that there are 400 books written on Napoleon himself. And if that doesn't tell you anything, why do you have to add needless things that didn't happen in the movie? So how did this happen? How are you able to screw up Napoleon's life so badly as the movie did?
I think possibly the biggest problem we've got with the whole project, and something that other people have said as well, and I'm going to add my voice to them, which is that honestly, it's a big project to do to try and fit that in. I think just the idea of saying, yes, I want to do any person's life in 2 hours on film, I know the defense will always be that, yeah, it's got 4 hours because it's director's cut. No. Theatrical release, 2.5 hours. That's a big project anyway.
I mean, to be fair, you can have 10 seasons about Napoleon with 23 episodes and you still wouldn't do it justice.
Absolutely. I think but that's still, the key thing with this. There's so much of a desire to capture every element of his life, every bit, and to find a new way of telling it. I think, honestly, there needs to be a bigger understanding within filmmaking, but I think within popular culture, that you've always got to take a side. You've got to pick a narrative, and particularly with the life of a man such as Napoleon, who, yeah, so much, such a
but
rich...
even in that limited time, like I said, his life is so exciting, you don't have to fictionalize his life. His life is exciting, like I said, it's exciting. I don't use this term enough, but it's exciting enough that you don't have to fictionalize. Then in the biopic, that's the key word, a biopic. That's kind of, it says, gives you, I mean, you have to be as close to the truth. And it's a movie, of course, it's going to be exaggerated. And it's a Ridley Scott movie, of course, it's going to be inaccurate. But still, it's be as close to the truth as you can when it's a biopic. This is a fiction of Napoleon. It's not a biopic movie, in my view.
No, absolutely. I think that's entirely a fair judgment. And I definitely think there's a lot to be said for, I guess, more generally with when we're looking at something like a biopic, is has the narrative they've taken, is it reflective of what we know? And I think that's where a lot of historians maybe have lost interest in this as a bit of media, because ultimately the narrative that he's chosen doesn't feel grounded, doesn't feel reflective of reality in some ways. And ultimately, there's a choice a lot of the way through, as you've said, to sort of not use that real event and to use a fictionalized version, which actually doesn't really feel any better. I can appreciate wanting to simplify things, but there are definitely so many occasions where there was an opportunity to use a real event, a real example of his behavior, a real letter, a real a personal account, say, and instead there is a conscious decision to fictionalize something to make it easier to understand, but I don't think it does, and that's I think where a lot of people really don't have the patience with it, quite frankly.
And I want to do a comparison because we talked about that, how much can you really do in 2 hours? And to do a comparison with another biopic that came out, the Oppenheimer movie, it really stays close to the truth. It's really grounded to reality. And it's really, I read the biography that the movie was inspired on after the movie. And I recognize so many things in from scenes from the movie in that biography. So the Oppenheimer movie is as close to a real life story as on him that we can get from a 2.5 hour movie. And so there is, you can do it. It just, you have to, you find the right director. And with the Scott is obviously not, for me, it was not the right choice for this.
Absolutely. I think particularly looking at Oppenheimer, which I think is a really great example of a comparison because it's a similar period in filmmaking when it's been made. It's not like comparing biopics made now and biopics made 50 years ago, say, because there's always going to be a tonal difference. But I think particularly with Oppenheimer, where Christopher Nolan and his writing team chose a specific story to tell. They didn't tell Oppenheimer's entire life history. They very much didn't, and there have been conscious decisions to cut and play with the narrative to make that work chronologically. But the key thing is they've chosen a narrative and stuck to that. And possibly where Napoleon as a film has maybe struggled so much is that it feels almost like, and I've seen other people say this before, it's almost like it's two films because clearly Ridley Scott and his screenwriter David Scarpa fell in love with the story of Napoleon and Josephine. I completely agree, it's a really fascinating story of two people. What they've tried to do, maybe in a sense to get people in to watch it, maybe because to get the funding, maybe because of just the need to have it, is to include that and battles. And I don't think there's really room in that sort of narrative to have that sort of love story and the series of battles that and the scale of battles which we associate with Napoleon in one film. I don't think it's just got the room to breathe and to have the narrative structure that it needs to. If you're going to tell a story of battles, tell a story of battles. If you're going to tell a story of two people, tell that story. And I don't think there was room to have them both work.
Another thing that had, of course, there's a lot with that's the title, Everything is Wrong with the Napoleon movie. And another thing I didn't buy Joaquin Phoenix. I think he's a fine actor. Like, I totally bought him as Commodus and as the Joker in the first Joker movie. I think he's a fine actor with all due respect, but it felt like he just gave up in the movie. And when he was angry, I didn't feel his anger. He was like, he was almost whispering at some point. I just didn't by him as Napoleon. And I said this before, I think, but one that comes to mind that I think would be perfect choice would be, and maybe it's a good thing that it wasn't cast in the movie, but Benedict Cumberbatch, I think from the top of my head, I think he would have been a splendid Napoleon personally for me, but I just didn't buy him Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon. And it just felt, like I said, it just felt like he gave up on the role. He realized how bad the script was. And
Interesting. I
so
think
that's
particularly.
my view on how Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon, but it just didn't feel the right choice to me. Not the age that people discuss, that was no problem for me. But in general, it just felt like I didn't buy him at all.
Interesting. I think it's certainly the thing. I know people are going to focus on the age, and we've talked about it before in every discourse ever I've been part of for this film. Particularly, I think for me that the one thing that the age casting maybe misses, and particularly I think people need to be aware of this, is that Napoleon was young when this stuff happened. He was born in 1769. When he takes Toulon, which is the first major military engagement we get in the film, he's 24. He's younger than I am now. When he's my age, he's conquering Italy. And that sort of, I was talking to someone earlier today as well that they were saying mid-30s, he was Emperor of the French. I think people sort of, a lot of the popular discourse got focused on what historians say he's too old. It's not about necessarily, oh, he's too old for the part because is what it is. It's that the scale of this stuff, you need to be reminded that this guy was young when he was doing this stuff. The really famous portrait of Napoleon at Arcole, is, as I've heard Zach White call him, his Rod Stewart era with this wonderful flowing locks. And there's a really couple of famous portraits of him when he was a bit younger as well. This quite sallow, sunken face. We need to be reminded that he was a young man and he was doing this stuff. Even in context, people were baffled at how much energy he had for this. I mean, I personally, in terms of just visually, Timothée Chalamet, I think, actually is probably one of those people who currently in the public consciousness is a pretty good visual match. And the fact that he's French, which I know isn't perfect, but, you know, we can't get everything. Finding Corsican actors who resemble Napoleon is not quite on everyone's list. But I think that key thing is that the casting isn't wrong because necessarily because he's too old for the part. The problem is the impact of that needs to really be felt by the audience. And so where Joaquin Phoenix, I think there are definitely places I agree where it feels like he just sort of lost his way a bit. And I think that possibly would have felt different had it been a younger cast member. I mean, equally, the other problem as well is about the Josephine should be older than him. And at the time, that's commented upon. And even nowadays, you find famous couples with an age difference where the woman is older. That's still a big deal. And that ultimately needs to be respected as that was a really important part of their dynamic. The fact that they fudged their marriage certificate, I believe, to make that seem less of a problem. It needs to be reminded to people that this is not just, oh, they're a bit older, a bit younger. It fundamentally shifts their dynamic as a couple. And I think it's something that we really missed ultimately.
I want to begin, not really not begin, but I want to talk, as we mentioned, is talk about the history interview with Ridley Scott. And it's clear that he doesn't understand history. It's rather a distorted view of history. When he said that only the two first books or something is worth reading as a case. And then he said, goes on to say, oh, there are 400 books written about Napoleon. But for anyone who's familiar with history and anyone who read history and historians as well, I think the opposite is true. The further you are away from an event, the less biased you're going to be. Because obviously, the two first books are going to be super biased. Like the people who knew Napoleon, for example, or knew the person that the knew and interviewed people. And though, of course, they are necessary because they give us a view that, you know, some of them were there. But I think the further away the less you are from an event, the less biased you're going to be. And the closer you are, obviously, going to have biased views on the event, the closer you are. For example, let's say the Russia-Ukrainian war. I read the comparison. I read the Plotkin's book, and there was so much bias. Obviously, because he's Ukrainian, and obviously there is going to be bias here, but let's say someone writing 100 years from now about the Russian-Ukrainian war, you are going to get less bias, a more neutral side, I think. So, but let's discuss the interview in general because it was also kind of a disaster.
Oh, absolutely. I think possibly what I worry most about that interview, and again, this has been trodden over by many people already. I don't want to sort of rehash discussions that have already been had, but I think that key thing of, well, were you there? Honestly, one, of course we weren't. That's an insane thing to think of anything. Two,
We have a TARDIS or something.
Our justice system works on, like, no one can be there. But that's such an insane thing to think about life, that because you didn't personally experience it, you aren't qualified to talk about it. Secondly, we do have people who are there. For example, I am holding in my hand the memoirs of Private O'Neill, who was a soldier in the 28th Regiment. He fought in the Napoleonic Wars. He wrote about Waterloo. It's in his memoirs. This sentence I think is quite interesting. This is a guy who was at Waterloo, but included in his chapter entitled "The Actions of My Actions That Day," Grouchy, if report may be believed, corrupted by British gold, remained in inglorious safety in his camp. That's categorically not true. This guy was here. Should we trust his word? I suspect not. The bigger problem with that, and as you quite rightly said, history and historiography is not about the first book. It's about what that book brings. And particularly the first histories of Napoleon were written by people who served under him, so who knew him, or if didn't serve under him, people who were around at the time, and maybe were bringing their own, say, national biases. Because I guarantee a Prussian history of Napoleon written at the same time would not be the same as a French history of Napoleon written at the same time. And that's the key problem with that comment, is not just that it betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of, I mean, how anything works in the world, But also the bigger concern is why historians do what they do, because historians don't just sit around talking at conferences, going for pints after work. History
Mean,
is a
some do,
discipline.
but
Well, yes, some do. I do occasionally. But historians as a discipline, it's much more about, okay, well, what do we know? What do we need to maybe have a guess at? And acknowledging that and having a discussion with those sources in a way that is clear what we're trying to argue. Historians don't just say, well, that person said it, so it must be true. And I think that comment, as much as I appreciate Ridley Scott didn't write the screenplay, I think David Scarpa has a very similar perception, because there are so many instances where, as I've said already, there were some really amazing examples that could have been used that we have a documented evidence for that weren't used. And I don't really see the reason why. I mean, the best example I can think of is Napoleon Josephine, where we get him talking to her in the voiceover. Now, we have some of his correspondence, not as much of it as I think some people would like, but some of it exists. And it's a real shame that we don't get some of that, because it, I think, speaks to not only how he felt about her. I mean, there's a great line in one of the letters from when he's in Italy. The charms of the incomparable Josephine kindle continually a burning and glowing flame in my heart. Now, that's a wonderful sentence to say about someone, but he's saying that as he knows he's sleeping with Hippolyte Charles. So the question there is, well, why is he writing this stuff? And again, you could say, well, he's written that, we should just take it verbatim. But actually, is there a subtext there? And so that's what I think is so frustrating about that comment, is that it betrays a fundamental misunderstanding and disrespect of what the historical discipline really is about.
I want before we go into the movie itself, I want to discuss the things that weren't in the movie and that absolutely are vital to Napoleon's history. For example, there were no mention of Spain. Bernadotte was vital at the Battle of Leipzig because he used Napoleon's own tactic against him. And Leipzig, by the way, is why he was exiled to Elba. And when Bernadotte used his own tactic against him, which he did not expect at all, like that's how they won. And Leipzig as well went there, and there's a giant monument there that's really cool to visit if you are in Leipzig, that's dedicated to Napoleon. No mention of the Italian campaign. You had not the history of Tilsit, which did not happen that way at all. We don't come back to that, of course, but that's just some of the things I mentioned as well that went in the movie that probably should have been. And maybe we see this in the 4-hour cuts, I don't know, but let's discuss some of the things that were vital to Napoleon's history that weren't in the
Yeah.
movie.
I think particularly with Italy, it's almost more egregious than that, because not only is it not included, but the line is included. The line is said, "It fell without a fight." And for that, you could come away from that film thinking that Italy did, Napoleon just turned up and they surrendered. And not only did Italy not fall without a fight, Napoleon spent several years there, as indeed did a lot of the French army, and indeed the Austrian army. The film very much feels a bit like, I don't want to use the word hatchet job as the wrong word, but it feels a bit like a character assassination, because it's clearly meant to show Napoleon at his worst. We're getting him not as a very considerate lover, we're getting him as not a very charismatic guy, we're getting him not as a very good general. He seemingly is just lucky and sort of bluffs his way through. The Battle of Arcole is a really fascinating example of Napoleon taking control of his own propaganda and using that incident. For those who aren't aware, the French line is struggling to take this bridge. Napoleon picks up a flag and goes, I'm leading the charge. Now, whether he does that or not is irrelevant. That's the story that goes out, and Napoleon controls that narrative. If you want to character assassinate him, show us that. Show us him literally controlling the mass perception of himself. That's such a missed opportunity.
I would rather see that than the scene in Lyon where it takes the British. That would have been so much cooler to see.
Oh, exactly. And the same with looking at Egypt. So we get him being in Egypt. We get a very odd sequence where someone shoots a pyramid and then an Ottoman falls off his horse and then they win. We don't see Napoleon's eyesighting against himself, which we know he did, because he was absolutely an artillery officer. And actually, on that note, I mean, the biggest glaring omission for me, probably, other in terms of the earlier stuff, is the fact that Toulon, we don't get any illustration of him being a tactical genius. So, for those who aren't aware, when he arrives at Toulon, the siege isn't going very well. To try and encourage men to be willing to put their lives on the line to build fortifications, he builds this battery for men without fear right in front of the British camp. And he says, those who serve there clearly are brave men. We don't get any of that. And we don't get him, again, taking control of his own narrative, taking control of that story. And then when we do get to things like Tilsit, which just is completely missed. I know you've got feelings about Tilsit, so.
So I'm glad you mentioned Egypt as well. And something I want to bring up as well, I was a bit let down because there were no, I didn't feel any Easter egg for the history buffs and the ex and the nerds. I'm not that I'm a massive nerd on that probably necessarily, but even I would have been glad, appreciated some Easter eggs in the movie, you know, and a bit nods here and there. For this, you know, something extra for the history buffs that could have been cool, just a little add-on. For example, in Egypt, they found the Rosetta Stone. That's in the British, of course, it is in the British Museum today.
Absolutely.
But that would have been cool to see instead of the needless scene in Alexander, which you don't have, for example, oh, we found this stone, you should have a look at this, and what should we do with it? And that would have been a bit cool little Easter egg, you know, that for the fans of history and in general that could you know, oh, that actually I recognize this scene, I read about it, and that's really cool to see. Or for example, a mention of, like I said, Bernadotte earlier or something like that.
Absolutely.
And when it comes to him leaving Egypt, it was also really risky when he was going back to France, because the British had basically captured the entire Mediterranean as the swimming pool, and you know, Napoleon had to be careful, so it should have been a kind of, we should have had a, and again, maybe we see this in the 4-hour cut, I don't know, but it should have been a cool chase scene with the British Navy on, right on the back of him, and maybe it would have been a waste of time, I don't know, but it should have been a cool chase scene with Napoleon barely just making it to back to France from Egypt, and we didn't see
Absolutely.
The suffering that the Egyptians, sorry, the French, had to endure in Egypt either, because it was they died of the malaria, dysentery, and the heat, and they were low of supplies. We don't see any of this either in the movie, that they suffered in on the Egyptian campaign, and they did lose eventually, but you know, it's, we don't see any of that part that should have been added so much to the movie, and I didn't feel at all, you know.
Absolutely. And that, again, coming back to this idea, I mean, it becomes more obvious. I mean, I was trying to look through my notes. I think it occurred to me that it was trying to be a character assassination when he gets to Moscow. That's how long it took for me to actually realize, oh, this isn't meant to be nice, is it? But particularly at Acre, we get Napoleon being absolutely awful to his men.
Yeah.
He marches them through the desert repeatedly, seemingly doesn't really care too much how many of them die in the process, and then abandons them to go and take part in the Brumaire coup. Now, we get almost none of that in the film. And again, if you're going to character assassinate him, pick the nasty stuff. Like, if you've made a decision, which Ridley Scott and David Scarpa clearly have, that Napoleon wasn't a nice guy, show us him actually not being a nice guy. I mean, the same with, we get this very one-sided depiction of him and Josephine's relationship, where she has all the affairs. He was having affairs pretty consistently as well, as indeed was sort of the societal norm, I should point out. So we sort of, again, if you're going to try and make this guy look awful, show us him being awful, particularly with Alexander. At the time, there were suggestions that him and the Tsar of Russia were, well, potentially having something, and historians since have picked up on that as a thread. Whether it's true or not, that seems a great opportunity for some character assassination. Let's make the guy cheating and make him cheating with a monarch. And let's you know, there's really an opportunity there that just doesn't get...
If you are going to fictionalize something, that would have been a good opportunity.
Exactly. I mean, for those, I don't know if you've seen the film The Favourite, which I would thoroughly recommend everybody interested in this period in 18th century watch, that is predicated on one contemporary newspaper account that the Queen of England may have been sleeping with her friend Lady Marlborough. No evidence for it at all, but that film is an incredibly grounded piece of cinema, but hung on that one thing. You could absolutely have made an incredible film about this love triangle between Napoleon, Josephine, and Alexander, but instead we get Alexander not really showing up much until the very end, at which point he tries to flirt with Josephine and then she dies. So it's a very odd dynamic the whole way through, really.
I must confess, though, I actually quite liked the actor who and the role of Alexander. I think he should have been more, but I didn't quite like him as a character. That's it. About one of the few things I liked in the movie, Alexander. We'll, of course, come back. I want to postpone a little bit, but I quite liked the portrayal of Alexander in the movie, actually.
Yeah, there's definitely some good pieces and again good elements of his depiction, because as a guy, Alexander's a really fascinating character
Absolutely.
in the context of the Russian court and the European power dynamic that was being set up as well. I've got to say that the car I've got a note when I got to Austerlitz. Miles Jupp is one of the weirdest casting decisions in the entire film, because the Kaiser of Austria
Yeah,
again
I
is a
didn't buy it.
fascinating.
That was disappointing as well.
Yeah, and again, it's a fascinating character who just doesn't really get explored. And we can sort of pick about things that are missing here. There's definitely some key elements that are missing. But I think if you're going to try to character assassinate the guy, there are so many opportunities that are just missed. And the other thing that really is missing, I think, for me, Napoleon was a charismatic guy. We know he was. People commented on it. People noted at the time they found him very charismatic in person. I don't really find him charismatic at all, and part of that is is Joaquin Phoenix and his portrayal, which I think we there are definitely some things left to be desired. But I think the script doesn't make me feel like he's the conqueror of Europe. This is not a man I feel compelled to go and lay down my life for, where
Yeah.
we know men did. So I think that's again something else that's really missing is that key. There's lots of missing elements along the whole thing, but there's such a missing thread of demonstrating who this guy actually was, because you can change things around, you can cut things out of the story, but if you miss the key thing, which is that Napoleon was a very charismatic guy who clearly knew what he wanted, we just don't get that impression.
Let's talk about some of the court members that we see, and
Yes.
I want to talk about in the French court and the Napoleon. I want to point out Talleyrand especially. I think again, if you go, like you said, if you're going to make Napoleon a douche, you should have added the scene where he calls Talleyrand a piece of shit, supposedly. That would have been a funny scene to have, where he get angry at Talleyrand. And then again, I'm disappointed it was so very few scenes, because Talleyrand was also again vital with Napoleon's the betrayal of Napoleon. I would like to see Talleyrand maybe put behind the scenes a little bit and then planning, and because he okay, Napoleon is getting out of hand. We need to stop this guy. He should kind of have been the anti-hero of the movie in a way, and it would have been cool to see him and Boucher barely get one mention in the whole movie, and again another important character in the French court and as well, and a fascinating. I should do an episode about him in the future. But and Talleyrand, of course, awards Alexander as well, and that Napoleon has intention of marrying your sister. And we don't see any of this, and I think it's so missed opportunity used maybe as an anti-hero or anti kind of a bit opponent to Napoleon, because Talleyrand was very much an opponent of Napoleon in the court, and he get one of the people to get away with and actually survived the entire reign.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a point that I think it's a shame that this, and again, I think possibly it fell victim to its own ambition. And again, this comes back to it being such an it's insanely large period, is that we get so many people. We don't really, as someone who knows the period, I have to Google half the cast. Oh, sorry. I think that person's meant to be. That's meant to be Berthier. I think is that Davout.
Yeah.
As someone who's familiar with the period, I really struggled. I mean, I don't want to use other examples for the sake of it, but The Death of Stalin, which is an incredibly good
Yeah.
film, and I do
Oh,
recommend
absolutely.
the introduction we get to these characters. They've nailed down eight or nine key component casts they need to introduce, and we get them introduced properly. Here is a second
A big
just to
headline
acknowledge.
and slow motion.
Yeah. Who this person is, because this person is important.
Yeah.
The only person we really get that for, it's not even Josephine, really. We get Wellington, I guess, gets a couple of seconds of this is Duke of Wellington, and you can tell because it's Rupert Everett sneering. It's sort of a shame we don't really get, yeah, these amazing characters, and particularly in the French court. If you want to set Napoleon up as a bad guy, let's show him being awful to the French people, because he absolutely used censorship. Fouché and Talleyrand ran a government for him that was not kind. And again, missed opportunity. If you're going to character assassinate the guy, do it properly. show him as the really awful tyrant that he absolutely was in places. So I'm going to anger the whole of the Napoleon fanboys by saying that. But and I'm
There is a scene where I don't remember who, but there's a, I think it's Talleyrand meeting an Austrian ambassador or something. Dude, that was that Metternich, because Metternich as well, I had a little fun cameo on Easter egg for the history of that. But was that Metternich? I'm not quite sure. There was an Austrian guy that Talleyrand meeting one scene. I'm not quite,
Oh,
I had a
yes.
feeling that was Metternich, but I'm not quite sure it was, to be honest.
I'm running down the actual cast list on Wikipedia now because I've genuinely forgotten. I know who you're talking about. I know the sequence. But again, I couldn't tell you who the person was. And that's a shame because if you're going to, okay, fine, have him be generic Austrian diplomat, sure. But just make it very clear this is just a random Austrian.
Because Metternich was a vital, as well, was a vital part of the Napoleonic era, and he would have been cool to have a cameo if you like for the Austrian, and like you said, for the Austrian ambassador, for again as an Easter egg for the history nerds who is fairly well versed in the era as well.
Absolutely. Metternich, I've got a note about this, but by him later anyway, so I'll bring it up now. Particularly looking at when we get the Congress of Vienna, and this is something that I think David Scarpa, I think, is very much of a problem within this script, which is that it's almost this assumption that the French only really cared about Britain. There's almost this idea that everything is building up to Waterloo. Now, in historiography, when something has an endpoint, we tend to use the word teleology, that it's got an endpoint that it builds towards. This film very much like it feels like Waterloo is the climax. Like it's obvious it's going to build to Waterloo. It's obvious it's going to get there. And this is a problem we have in I find with a lot of history anywhere that's written by Anglo-centric historians. Other nations were important. The Congress of Vienna is not being run by Wellington. Metternich is fundamentally controlling the peace as much as he can. Wellington has a lot of credit because he's known as this incredible general, but the other nations are by no means happy with Britain riding roughshod over them. But I think in this version, we very much get it's almost like the coalitions are Britain and Friends, Volume 1, Britain and Friends, Volume 2, which is true up to a point. But I'm sure they wouldn't have appreciated that. And so this idea that Wellington is the one calling the shots at Vienna is, I appreciate for simplicity, they want to try and make it easy. We could at least have had someone else telling Napoleon, oh, I am an Austrian, I sort of care. I'm important, I promise.
Before we go into the campaigns, I want to we talked a little bit about this, but let's talk about the dynamic between Joaquin Phoenix and I don't remember the actress' name. I know she's been in
Vanessa Kirby.
several, Vanessa Kirby. Let's talk about the dynamic and how they portray, because the entire, like you said, the entire movie is basically Napoleon being a horn dog for Josephine, pretty much in it. Like, and I think again the chemistry I didn't really buy it, and it's let's talk about what your thoughts on the Josephine Napoleon, because of course
Absolutely.
important, and of course he loved Josephine, and of course she was kind of terrible to him as well, but let's talk about how this is portrayed in the movie.
No, absolutely. I think there's certainly, I'm by no means the best, most qualified person to talk about Josephine because she, the facts about her more generally are quite well known, that she was older than him, that she'd had two kids with a guy who had died. The kids in the film don't really show up apart from at the end, Hortense shows up when Josephine's dying, which is, I guess
Also,
she.
interesting fact that Eugene's daughter married Napoleon the Third as well,
Yes.
doesn't she?
But again, I think that's a good point. I want to come back to in a second, actually. But particularly with Josephine, she does make him palatable to Parisian society up to a point. Not perfectly. It's not like she's the key that unlocks Paris to him or anything, but as far as I'm aware. But and the film does sort of hint at that a bit. And it's nice that when they first meet, yeah, she's got her hair cut short because she was imprisoned. But I think unfortunately, that age difference fundamentally shaped possibly how Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby work together. Certainly from the interviews I've seen with them, there's always a power dynamic there that wasn't there at the time. And I think that does shape how their relationship is conveyed. So for the if you've ever seen A Knight's Tale, which is a great film, I do recommend it. There was a choice made in that film that the music was all going to be modern. So they have We Will Rock You playing at the Joust. They have David Bowie playing at the Court Dance because it's made a choice to be accessible to the audience. The director said, "We know this wasn't there, but we need to make the audience understand what this feels like." And the best way we've got that is using modern music. So we use the equivalent. The Jousters are like rock stars. Let's use Queen because that's the best comparison we've got in our modern culture. I think that's the same decision. There should have been a decision made here to say, no, she needs to be older because at the time they found it weird and we find it weird now. As much as it shouldn't be a problem, and absolutely it shouldn't be, culturally, it is rare to find women older than men
I
in
mean,
those
Jason
sort of
Momoa's wife
relationships.
is 10 years older, isn't she?
Yeah,
An
and there
example.
is always a big deal made out of that. I mean, particularly, it's not Holland,
Also,
it's
by the
current.
way, Eleanor of Aquitaine were about 10 years older than Henry II as well, so it
Yeah,
wasn't
which again was
surprising
odd at the
to
time. And she's a really great example, actually. I think it's the biggest thing with their relationship is that fundamental incorrectness in their casting, I think, shapes an awful lot of how the dynamic happens because then she always feels like she's on his arm, which at the time that wasn't necessarily always the case. I think the biggest thing we have is that I don't really buy them liking each other. And this might just be the way the script's written. I don't, from the performances I saw together, they seem to have quite good chemistry on set, but I don't buy that they actually liked each other. Just because I said earlier, we've got their correspondence, we've got their writing about each other. It would have been amazing to hear some of that. And particularly looking at
I
the
want to
later
know about that.
stage.
Was there actually any dialogue in real letters
I
in the
suspect
movie?
I don't recognize any. I did nothing felt Napoleonic. He's got a certain way of writing from what I've seen. I mean, particularly with when the decision comes to having to him divorcing her, they did remain quite friendly, and that's one thing I'm glad that was portrayed is the fact they did actually remain on quite good terms from everything I can find.
The one thing that actually happened, though, as far as I remember correctly, he didn't bring his baby to Josephine when he married Marie Louise of Austria, and which, by the way, I wanted to bring it up right now. That is that we never got to see because she called him the Ogre of Corsica. We never got to see her kind of presenting. Maybe there was not fair enough. There may have not been time to show this, but she really resented Napoleon until she got to know him. And it would be kind of fun to see when she enters that she's kind of I don't really want this guy. I'm not really interested. That she to see a little bit of resentment in the one scene that she Marie Louise is in. It would kind of be fun to see her kind of resenting man. Oh, maybe not calling the Ogre of Corsica, but it would have been fun to see her resenting a
Yeah.
little bit as she did in real life.
And again, to see that charisma because he just doesn't, he sort of comes across. I don't want to sort of be too derogatory about it, but it feels very much like he's made a deal and she's shown up and then they have a kid. But I think, particularly with that, and again, going back to this idea of character assassination, if you want a hypocrisy, he tries to effectively buy himself into the monarchy of Europe. Marie Louise is the daughter of the Austrian Kaiser. He's almost buying his status as an equivalent. And the fact that he puts his family on, and again, we sort of don't really get any of the family members because there's too much to fit in anyway. But the fact that we get his family and in-laws being chucked on the thrones of various
We
nations.
do get his mother briefly.
We do. And his mother actually is brilliant. She is given that she's in it for about 5 minutes, I think she's incredible because we know that she was a very forceful personality. And he clearly adored her as a mother. Equally, I think he got sick of her
And it's funny
from
that the
Spain.
family actually disliked Marie Louise more than they disliked Josephine.
Yeah, and again, we don't really get any of this discussion. And again, if you're going to character assassinate the guy, have it be really obvious. I am marrying her so that I can become a king. Have him be, I don't want to be a king, I'm not a king, and outright say, I'm buying her so I can be a king. Make it really obvious. Because again, this is a great opportunity that we just don't get explored. And instead, we get him shouting about pork chops and then this weird pregnancy test thing, which is just a very, I was sat in the cinema just going, I mean, did someone at all stages of this, someone approved this sequence? It's a very odd sequence where we've got this weird. Like his mum sends a young girl effectively, and then she's pregnant, so therefore he should divorce Josephine. It's just a very weird moment that again, we don't there's no evidence for it. Why is it in there? There would have been better ways to have that conversation on screen that would have been, I think, more compelling and ultimately less weird.
And another thing I want to bring up when it comes to Easter egg, because we discussed this in, I think, part one of our Napoleon miniseries, is that Josephine likes to buy hats. And it would be funny mention, like, and I don't remember if it was there. I needed a few pints to get through the movie, to be honest with you. But it would have been fun to ask him, if he asked Napoleon, sorry, Josephine, like, do you really need to buy this many hats? And then you see, like, you're back closer to something. Like, it would have been another fun little Easter egg. And again, there were no Easter eggs that I could think of in the movie that were little nods and here and there for the extra fans of the Napoleonic era.
No, absolutely. And there's definitely, I think, to be fair, it also goes on to the fact that it's quite a dull film in terms of being able to show off the fashion of the period. There's some incredible stuff. I mean, I appreciate we don't want to go into the nuances of how the Empire line, the Empire basically develops because of Napoleon's sister, Caroline. It's a really fascinating period of fashion history. We don't really get to see any of it because it's grey and blue most of the way through, apart from in Egypt when it's bright yellow. And that's also a real missed opportunity because, I love uniforms. I'm a bit of a button nerd. I'll happily admit that. I do love seeing properly done uniforms. We don't have to see all of them be perfect. It'd be nice to be able to actually see them. There's some incredible uniforms that we just don't really get shown at any point. I mean, particularly looking at Napoleon's consulate uniforms and later, some of them are incredible. We've got they survive. I mean, Murat. There's a whole separate conversation about Murat, but.
I was just about to mention another vital character, and who again marry both Napoleon's sister, which is a match, like we said, in again to refer to our Napoleon episode, it's a match made in hell. It's he isn't even in the movie as far as I remember. So he again I needed a few pints to get through the movie, but so I don't quite remember if he was even mentioned, but Murat is as well not in the movie at all as far as I remember.
Absolutely not, when it absolutely should be. And the fact is, this is a period which is famous for being a visual spectacle. Like, we've got incredible uniforms, incredible scales of formations. This should have looked amazing. I really don't understand why there was a desire to put this grey blue colour filter over absolutely everything, which just for me robbed it of any character, I guess, with the uniforms, because they do look incredible. I mean, there's some wonderful examples that anyone can go and Google. I've got to say, I do love the Dutch grenadier uniforms. It's bright white with the red facings, massive bearskins for the grenadier. It's just a spectacle. And I don't understand why we didn't get even a semblance of that sort of colour on the screen, which just we've absolutely missed. So that for me was a real small thing to really matter.
There's something else we don't get to see that Napoleon had the opportunity to make peace, and with that one scene where he meet the British and they're horrible, that you think you're so great just because you have boats. And we don't see I didn't feel we got any chance where he get the opportunity to, and now we don't get into the campaigns in the movie in a second, but we don't get to see any of the opportunities that he had to actually make peace. And in the beginning, of course, William Pitt the Younger, well, I believe they wanted peace as well, because Britain was almost, I believe, broke at the time as well. And we don't see any opportunity that Napoleon had to make peace. And it could have been cool to you, like, we offer you this chance to have peace. And then Napoleon just like, no, I'm not having peace. I'm going to conquer the entire Europe, and you're just gonna have to get along with it. We don't get to see that again with the charge the assassination. That could have been a great opportunity to see him have the opportunity for peace, but he rejected and just walked out on British or the Austrians or whatever. We do get to,
Absolutely.
again we'll come back to the Peace of Tilsit, but in a second. But we did get the opportunity to see one peace treaty in the movie, but still, it was a missed opportunity, I think.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in terms of that line where he goes from being emperor
Yeah.
and keeps rejecting peace overtures and keeps rejecting these quite good offers. I mean, particularly for the costuming, would have been incredible to see as well, is that the uniforms do change in this period. That they, particularly in the higher ranking, particularly the uniforms that he's wearing, we go from being Republican French, which we see in the early years, to seeing his crest is stamped on stuff. This wonderful image of the B. The N becomes a more a bigger problem, a bigger thing, particularly on the Chaka plates, for example. I would have loved to have seen that, just that conveyed in the costume, which is a very small thing, but actually, if you're watching it and going from seeing tricolours, seeing republicanism over this span to seeing Napoleon, we get that subtextual message that maybe he was a tyrant. And again, if you're going to character assassinate the guy, why is that not in that? Because that would have been an incredible opportunity again to convey this message that clearly David Scarpa doesn't like the guy. Let's really make it obvious that he was not a nice person and demonstrate that in so many ways, not just people saying he was not very nice. So yeah, no, I think it's just, yeah, there's so many missed opportunities here. If you're going to convey a story, to convey that coherently across the whole film, and it just doesn't feel like there's that narrative structure that would have, I think, helped convey that.
Now, I want to bring up as well. I had something, there was on the tip of my tongue. I was going to bring up something right, and then I kind of forgot. Sorry about this, but that's, oh yeah, the coronation of Napoleon. That's what I want. That's actually one of the few things I believe that the movie gets right, sort of, the coronation. I don't know if you agree with me, but the coronation of Napoleon as an emperor is one of the few things that, I think the movie got right.
Absolutely. I think it's bizarre. I've got friends who live in Lincoln and were sending me, we've got there's some filming outside, there's some filming at Lincoln, and then seeing Lincoln Cathedral converted into Notre Dame, I believe. It is Notre Dame, isn't it? It's a really great scene. And I think actually, yeah, you are right. That's probably the closest we get to a glimmer of what this film could have been, which is that it really goes hard on it, making, the propaganda is there. We get that famous incident where Napoleon crowns himself. The really silly thing for me that really stands out, and I appreciate they've made the decision to put it all in English for narrative purposes, which makes sense, and I completely appreciate that being something that's useful for the audience. I do think "Vive l'Empereur" sounds better than "Long live the Emperor," just audibly. I think it sounds better, and particularly with the way that that is shouted when you hear about it, and particularly the way that the French sounds. I think it sounds much better, and it sounds a really silly thing. But adhering to that and the fact they chose to translate that particular phrase, again, it's that Anglocentrism that's slightly drifted through a lot of the story. Because that visually, it's a really great scene. We get this, and again, I think it's a shame the costuming is so good, actually, because there's so many amazing moments that are obscured by the blue filter. It's a wonderful scene. I do think you're right. It's a really great moment. It possibly is one of the better bits in the film.
And another thing that I think would have been like a fun little note, and if you want to, or other than just the French, sorry, the British in the scene, how they also a little bit more, it would be to have the dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire that Napoleon does in 1805, 1806. I don't remember exact year, but that would have been that again a little cool Easter egg, or just a mention, a dissolution the Roman and the Holy Roman Empire, because no. And just to brag about something to Talleyrand or someone, just a little bit of as a brag, a dissolution, a 1,000-year-old Reich, and it's no use anymore. And may again, it could have been the cameo with Metternich and the Emperor of Austria, and kind of as a little bit doing that. And it should be in the 4-hour cut. I don't know again, but it's we haven't. I will see the 4-hour cuts, and maybe I doubt the movie will be better. But it's going to be fun to see what was in the for what was left out of it. But still, the
Absolutely.
dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire, to get back to my point, it should have been a fun little nod and fun little Easter
I
egg
think
to
that's
be
possibly
in
where.
there.
Sorry, no, I think that's absolutely where this film struggles again. So I mentioned about it being a big project. I found one review from Jacobin.com, which is a great website. Napoleon lurches from the 1789 to 90, 1792 period of constitutional monarchy to the republicanism of the revolution's radical phase without missing a beat. I think that best sums up the problem with, as much as we can say, oh, well, the extended cut, it shouldn't need an extended
Yeah.
cut to feel coherent. And particularly with where we skip these massive chunks, we end up skipping all this subtext. And again, you can skip chunks, you can skip periods of history. That makes absolute sense. But when you're skipping, it's basically an Anglo-centric narrative that they've chosen to skip. For example, looking at Germany, if this was written by a German, this would not have skipped 1813, 14. It would not have skipped, as the Germans call it, the War of Liberation. Like, this is a really important period in German history that would not have been missed if this was written by a German. And I think that possibly is a bigger problem as well, where if this was, say, we do Napoleon, the German cut, and we take all this story from the German perspective, I think this changes an awful lot of how we get the narrative played out. And it's just a shame because, again, there's some really amazing stuff, but the revolution gets massively oversimplified in this anyway, because in Britain, we don't really know much about it. In British culture, the revolution basically is the Bastille and then Napoleon.
Yeah.
And that's sort of it. And I think
You
that's
don't,
possibly.
and nothing about Robespierre's terror regime or anything
Yeah.
like that.
Or he becomes a joke as Scarlet Pimpernel. That's
Yeah.
basically it. We don't really get anything else.
Yeah.
And so I think this film changes a lot if you get a different writer in.
I want to go
It's
back
possible.
to mentioning Robespierre. I want to go back to the very beginning because again, and for the, I get the simplicity that they shouldn't really. What do you think about this Robespierre supposedly? Because there is theorized that he was assassinated, but it was in his room, not in the court when he tries to escape. And but again, I can get it, but I needed to kind of fast forward a little bit that couldn't show him in this room, just kind of sitting there and suddenly trying to take his life. I get that. But what was your take on the murder of Robespierre or his suicide attempt in, sorry,
Yeah, I think
in
Robespierre is a
the
fascinating character, and again, this is where the film suffers from being so condensed, because this is such a complex period in political history, in French history, in cultural social history. The reason Robespierre is overthrown isn't really actually ever really explained. It's sort of just inferred, and it's a real shame. Sam Troughton, another random British actor that gets pulled into this thing. Sam Troughton is a dead ringer for Danton. It's a real shame he was playing Napoleon, because Sam Troughton, who is an incredible actor, who I first saw on the BBC Robin Hood 15 years ago now, actually, is an absolute dead ringer for Danton. It would have been wonderful to see some of that. It's a shame we didn't get, French constitutional debate, reform debates, which I'd have found fascinating, but I don't think would have brought in the crowds. And particularly looking at his suicide, we don't really get a context for why it happens. It's just something that happens. And that, again, is where I think the film. It feels like it needs to include this because it's a really important watershed moment in the revolution as to when Napoleon really gets this opportunity to begin flourishing within the revolutionary government. But it doesn't really feel like it's contextualized properly. So it
Yeah.
sort of happens because it has to, rather than happens because it needs to, if that makes sense. It's not like
Yeah.
it's something that the film wants to show us. It's something that they just, oh, well, you've heard of Robespierre, you've heard of the National Convention, I guess we should show him dying so we can show time, when actually I think it would have been far more interesting and useful, I think, for the public to skip potentially straight to the 13th Vendémiaire Royalist uprising, because actually I think that would have helped us better grasp Napoleon's rise without seeing effectively a quite a pointless sequence. Even though it's a great sequence to have included, I don't think it was necessary.
Yeah.
And instead, the Royalist uprising we could have had a bit more context for, because in the film it is Napoleon gunning down 20 civilians and a cat or something, when actually it's a concerted uprising. They are armed. The cannon were necessary because there was actually a threat to life to the French government. And particularly Napoleon's response, we just see him giving the order to fire. What he actually does is he orders a very risky maneuver to have Murat, which is when he meets him, to go and get the cannon from this artillery park. And he again is personally involved in sighting the cannon and fighting back. So this could have been a really good moment to again demonstrate Napoleon being a risk taker and that being a bad thing. Instead, we get a couple of minutes of Robespierre being on screen for almost no reason. He shoots himself, which is broadly correct. I can forgive them trying to cut that for the sake of time and everything, but we just don't get a reason of why it's actually put on screen, and that's, I think, the real problem.
And I want to get into the campaign, which I'm sure is what most people are excited about when it comes to Napoleon. And I want to begin with the campaigns that weird in the movie. And yet it's with time, and it's you can't have everything. But I think Trafalgar should have been in the movie because it's also an important part. But it should have been a great navy sequence instead of just having landlocked battles. It should have had a even if it was just a 3, 4 minutes, 5 minutes scene. It should have been great to see something different in the movie. Have an epic navy shootout, you know, against the French navy and the British navy. Show the strength of force that the British were known for their navy, and you know, it would have been cool to see this as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think possibly the problem will have been time and also money, because
Yeah, that's
getting
fair enough. Yeah.
a boat, as David Scarper puts it in the script, boats are expensive to get, especially good boats for this sort of period. My main concern with adding the naval element, and it's again one of those things that we've picked aside on this, which is that it's a Napoleon story. He's not involved. It would be good to see it
Yeah.
mentioned, I do agree, because at least to have some context for why certain things are happening. Because that happening when it does, as a historian of home defense, which is my broadly my remit, that's really the key line upon which Britain stops worrying about a French invasion. And that does then shift British and French relations more generally, because with the British no longer really concerned about French invasion in a way that is, it's not a concerted effort. If they're going to invade, it'll be a couple. It won't be the big fleet that is feared for actually most of the 1790s. With that gone, the British become much more proactive on the continent. And that would have been really useful to again have this context of the British being annoying things that don't go away to suddenly being the major issue by the end of the period. Which we don't really get again, because of course the British were always there, because it's been written by an Anglo-centric historian, well, Anglo-centric writer.
It's and then this probably wouldn't have been necessary, but it would kind of be fun to see because Britain at that time they weren't a favorable ally. Nobody really wanted to be on Britain's side. It's until a certain point, I think, under the Napoleon War, Britain suddenly become everyone's favorite ally, and it would kind of been a little bit fun to have this at least kind of see the British struggle to find an. Of course, it's from Napoleon's point of view, but it would have been fun to see a little bit from their side as well, you know, and see them struggling to try to find an ally who can defeat Napoleon with them, that they're not alone in this.
No, absolutely. And I think it possibly, again, it's something that we as a society like easy answers. And I think, unfortunately, you've got so the web of foreign relations in this period, it's not A likes B, B likes C. It's so much more complicated than that. And so looking at the peace treaties that get drawn up, for example, Tilsit, the Russians sort of agree to go along with the continental system. And that's really that they sort of agree for it, because ultimately they're not massive fans of Britain, but equally, and there's always stuff going on behind it. So that's possibly where this film struggles as well. And again, running time, you've got to try and tell a story, is that there's a lack of depth of why these nations were cooperating. And they weren't cooperating because they wanted to work together, they were cooperating because Napoleon was a bigger threat, particularly looking in the earlier period. And this is 1792, 3, 4, early years. The Prussians and the Austrians really don't have a massive problem with the French Revolution until it starts threatening their own territories. Because ultimately, as long as it's contained, and it is contained west of, of Switzerland and of the Rhine and so forth, the bigger priority is Poland, particularly up until the rest of the partition. So when we look at this period on this in this film, we sort of get a sense of why these people are working together. We sort of presume from the beginning it's because they don't like the French, or we don't like Napoleon. And it's a shame that we maybe don't get this again, character assassination, back to this the key theme. If it goes from disparate nations to actually working together because we don't like him specifically, it would have been amazing to see that. And again, we don't get that discussion, which is a real shame.
And speaking of the Austrians as well, it would have been fun in the beginning to see the text of why was Marie Antoinette executed. And it was one of the reasons that she was found guilty was because she was sending treasonous letters and correspondence with the Austrians to try to invade No, having just as a little text in the beginning of the film, Marie Antoinette was executed because she sent treasonous letters to Austria about the French army, or as to what, and then and why, as she tried to help them free her and Louis in when they tried to send in the Austrian army to counter the revolution. Having just as a little text in the beginning, why, well, of course, everyone knows why she was kind of executed, but have it a bit more detailed for those who aren't as enlightened as you and me are on the French Revolution and this period,
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could have been as blunt as the French Revolution said that she was conducting treason. It could have been as simple as that. The French Revolutionaries said that Marie Antoinette was treasonous. That's all it could have been. Just to give it that sense that that's what they thought. I mean, particularly with her execution, it feels again like a scene they put in because they felt they had to, not because it was relevant. We sort of get Napoleon sneering at her a bit,
Which he
and then
was not
suddenly.
the executioner at the time as
Exactly, and
well.
then he's suddenly rash to go and see Barras. I mean, I will say when the two guards grab her, they're wearing red coats. That is correct. It's a really silly thing they got right, but they did give them the correct Swiss Guard uniforms, which is fascinating because they got that right. They didn't have someone in the costume did really good work on this film, and it's great that it's actually included in some capacity. I mean, the other thing is a shame is again. His uniform doesn't change at all, but that's a whole separate conversation. I mean, the biggest one, really, if we're going to go with the Austrians, is Austerlitz. I don't know how much we should
We
just
should
spend.
probably talk more about the campaign at this point, because I'm sure that's a theme of the hair as well. So let's talk about how the Napoleonic campaign. We spoke a little bit about Trafalgar, but let's talk a little bit about how the campaigns are portrayed. And let's talk about Napoleon as we don't because we don't really get to see him as an artillery commander, which was his education. So let's talk about how he's portrayed as a general, and how the campaigns. Of course, we don't talk about main subject is Austerlitz. So let's talk a little bit about the campaign, and then go mainly and focus on Austerlitz as well.
No, of course. I think that's possibly again where we sort of miss, and we get lots of really nice shots and very good looking shots actually of troops marching behind him. And possibly, I think something we miss. The Indiana Jones films are a really great reference point this actually. When they outright show on a map where he's flying to, which sounds really silly, but I think actually would have been quite useful because as an audience member who's not familiar with the geography of the area, I mean. My knowledge of geography of Central Europe is still really poor, and I've been studying this era for a long time. I really struggle to exactly remember where places are in relation to each other. It would have been really useful, I think, to have that, to be able to show
They
the
do show
reason
one
he was.
map when he enters Moscow, which we will come back to as well, but
Well, yeah, but it's not the same,
it's
and particularly with being able to demonstrate again why he was a good general.
yeah.
And I appreciate if this film doesn't want to show us his good points, then fair enough, but his good points were that he understood and he developed. Furthered on a system that was developing, which was this corps system, this idea by which armies would be effectively split into sub armies that were all independent but would concentrate for major campaigns. That's a really important hallmark of his strategy and of his understanding as a commander that we just don't really get shown. Which, again, if you're trying to squeeze in Josephine story and battle story, you've not got the room for. But it means that when we get to these big battles, we don't really get a sense of why they're being fought and ultimately why they're important as demonstrations of his ability.
I
I
mean,
mean,
again,
particularly.
to counter your point a little bit, it would be weird to have Napoleon without Josephine. That's fair enough. It would have been weird not to see her in the movie at all.
Yeah, I mean, particularly, I asked a friend about this, and they said actually, I think it would have almost been more powerful if we only saw the battles as small clips, and it basically was we're sitting with Josephine, getting these letters back from Napoleon on the front, going, yes, we won this battle, yes, we won this battle, because then we only really get her understanding of it. I think it would be a really powerful way of demonstrating the impact of those victories, because even what we're shown, we aren't really shown them in the context of. Good generalship, of good commanding, of good soldiering. We're shown them as Napoleon waved his hand and then the ice broke, which
Yeah,
isn't
let's talk
really
about
that
the
useful.
Austerlitz sequence a little bit, because and we spoke about this with Dr. Seth White in our part two of the episode, and he mentioned that it was kind of taken out of Napoleon's own written account of Austerlitz. That kind of was the inspiration for how the Austerlitz scene. And I gotta admit, I think that the War and Peace BBC series did Austerlitz better. than because they're just really trying to show the horror of the war when you see people losing their legs in the War and Peace BBC drama that happened a few years ago. I think they showed so much better the sequence and the horror of Austerlitz that it was than what the Napoleon movie did.
Absolutely. And again, we sort of have a, if we're going to go with side characters, I've got friends who will curse me if I don't mention Davout. The reason Austerlitz works is because Davout, the Iron Marshal, force marches his guys something like 40 miles in 2 days or 60 miles in 2 days. It's an insane thing to do. They arrive at the battle and they just deploy and get straight into action. But for us as an audience member, what I would love to have seen is that moment of Russians, Austrians marching through, great job, we're attacking them, lads, and then suddenly hearing French out of the mist, because that would have been terrifying. And that's, I think, what would have been an amazing experience to have shown on film, is that sheer terror. We don't need to see the rest of the battle. We don't actually need to see what happens, just that they thought they're winning and suddenly there are French in front of them. That would have been incredible.
It's been quite a long time, so we do have to rush a little bit. But I want to talk about the peace treaty of Tilsit because that's
Yes.
again another thing that just went wrong. It should have been a really cool. Again, I mentioned this a lot in this episode, but. Is again easier and not because one of the reasons that the peace treaty of Tilsit is kind of so famous is because nobody wanted to meet the Russians. Alexander did not want to meet on the French side, and Napoleon did not want to meet on the Austrian side. So they chose a river and they made a boat. The boat could meet on that was kind of neutral ground, and it would have been cool to see this instead. We get just a tent and. It would have been cool to kind of see that. That's one of the things I was like kind of looking forward to actually, but at seeing the Treaty of Tilsit, and I wasn't expecting much, but it could have been cool to just see that little boat on the river scene and
Yeah.
the actual how the peace treaty of Tilsit happened.
No, absolutely. I mean, particularly again, if we're going down that character assassination, keep going back to this because if that's clear what they're going to go for, let's make it properly. If we're thinking about Tilsit, we can have Napoleon being stubborn and going, no, I'm not meeting him the other side. I don't care what he says. We're not meeting him the other side of the river. Make him throw a stroppy fit about it and go, well, I'm not meeting. We'll meet him on a boat. We'll do a boat then. Fine. Have him be this really petulant, annoying person who doesn't want to, let this person and dictate his rules. Have him not understand that, because Tilsit, yeah, it's a fascinating peace treaty. It speaks volumes about, as I've said, European international relations in that period, about how these different nations were willing to work with each other. And the fact is, the Russians did agree to work with Napoleon. Alexander came to us a reasonable peace settlement that meant he was ha happy, in so many words, to work with Napoleon as a king. So the fact that that happens, we sort of don't get any context for that. We just get Miles Jupp red-faced drinking some port or something, and Napoleon saying, "Well, I could have defeated you. I could have destroyed your entire army if I wanted to." We don't get that really interesting discussion. And again, you're
He
quite
does kind of
right.
say to the Emperor of Austria, doesn't he? That you know.
Yeah. And I guess if it's trying to not show us Alexander too early, which is fine, but we don't really get much of Alexander at all otherwise.
Like you
And
said, he's one of the few characters I actually kind of liked the portrayal of in the movie. I thought it was did a fine job.
just would have been good to see
With
more of him,
what he
really.
had. And again, I don't remember if this is if Talleyrand was there. At Tilsit, or if he just wrote letters to Alexander, but it would have been cool to see if you don't want to be inaccurate, just have Talleyrand there and go, have a scene him telling Alexander before the treaty. Like, so Napoleon is planning to have a marriage with your sister. You should probably, sisters, or your, you should probably try to think of some good idea why this shouldn't happen. You want to marry into your family, and you should, I would advise not to do this. And have that little scene again, have a little Easter eggs like that for the nerds and nerds,
Absolutely. And I think it would have then lent a bit more context for why then Borodino and the A12 campaign has to happen. Because we would have understood part of the deal was that the Russians weren't trade with the British. Guess what they did? And that can be all it is. It's just, oh, the British, oh, they're getting more annoying. Why do they just stop trading? That would have been all it needed to take and to have that context. Because otherwise, Borodino sort of comes, it looks a bit like a rugby match. Like, it looks a bit like there's 20 cavalry on a school rugby field, charging a block of guys wearing some sort of green. And it sort of, again, has no context for it. It's very odd as that so much of the film seemingly, again, just sort of rolls through events that people are familiar with without actually putting time into explaining why they happen, until it is absolutely such an important point that just doesn't really get done properly. It just sort of, oh, well, it we made peace. We won, we made peace, that's it. End of. Which is a real
So,
shame.
yeah, I want to finish the Russian side as well because we don't get. I know you're excited about Waterloo and we don't get there in a second. But I want to talk about the March on Moscow. What is your take on the famous March on Moscow? Because when they come back from the theater, of course, we get the whole scene, like to talk about the sequence with the mother, the divorce of Josephine, and etc. etc. The one scene with Marie Louise. That she is in, and then it's, you know, he's decided the other kid and he march on to Moscow. And so let's talk about the famous march on Moscow.
Yeah,
Because I
I
didn't
mean,
really feel that, like we said, the Russian and the return did get some of it, but I didn't really feel like the soldiers were dying as they march. I would to make it more climax. I would have maybe had some soldiers see the line get thinner and thinner and thinner, you know. Like just have people fall around in the cold, just people sitting freezing and you see ice coming from them, or maybe have an amputation or two just to see how horrible the Russian myth. And if you don't have him, you know, character assassination, like you said, show. I didn't feel the climax on the march back to Moscow that it could have been.
absolutely. I mean, particularly the key thing about that march is so fascinating is that actually most of the losses from desertion are in the first couple of months. Most of the losses from desertion are as they're going in. Prussian Corps, for those who aren't aware as well, the Prussian army gets told by the king after about a month that they've changed sides. So they march into, I think it's, they get to Latvia, and then they just turn around because they've sent a message from the king, we're no longer allied with the French, come back, which is great moment. I do find that hilarious that they're literally on the way into battle and get no, we're turning around, no, we're gone, thanks. So we look at that. One, there's a desertion, a real problem with desertion. And two is that they set off in actually quite good conditions. It's summer, it's late summer, so it's not means the best ever, but it's not bad. And the point is that as they begin to get further into Russia, that Cossack strategy of drawing them further in, and Kutuzov catches real hell for this in the Russian court. He is made to fight at Borodino. Kutuzov does not want to. He's happy to keep pulling back and abandon Moscow, but it's made very clear to him that they need to make a stand because they cannot just keep abandoning Russians to the French. So that, I think that's a shame that we didn't get more of that. On the ground, you are right, though. I think it's a shame we didn't get more sense of how bad this was, because it really was not good. We get some awful accounts from the French soldiers who survive, and it doesn't feel grounded, is the best way of putting it.
And another thing that we missed, of course, and again, I get it, it's time, we can't have everything. But most movies today seem to be like 3 hours is the new 1.5, so it could have been in there. So it's the, of course, after the Moscow scene, we get Napoleon abdicate, but like we talked about earlier, the Leipzig would have been an epic scene to have a receding of allies using the forces. And Napoleon's own tactic against him. See Napoleon confused. Well, how is this happening? Why are they? How did they learn my tactics? You know, and why? How did they? And watch him in being dumbfounded by his defeat in the Battle of Leipzig. And again, this could have been sh shown excellent in what in the scene of Waterloo, which we'll get to in a second. But it would have been really cool to see that how they actually defeated Napoleon in the Battle of Leipzig. That was one missed opportunity. If you don't make the movie 2.5 hours, it wouldn't have hurt to have it 10, 15 minutes longer and have the
Yeah.
Battle of Leipzig there. And as I mentioned this earlier as well, there is a great monument. If you have are in Leipzig, you should absolutely visit the Napoleon Monument, which is an episode of film because it took over 100 years to build that monument that still stands there today. And you get a great view of a Leipzig if you are inside. I don't know if you've been there, but
It's on my list.
it's fascinating place.
I'm a reenactor of the Prussian land there, and it's on my list at some point to go to Leipzig because it's a fascinating. I think honestly, the reason it's not in here is because it's Anglo-centric, and it sounds silly, but the way that the film is cut, the first person who really defeats Napoleon is Wellington. The way it's cut, we actually don't really get him losing at any point up until Waterloo, and that is because the British need to be the ones to do it. I think showing Leipzig shows that the Europeans, we can't have them beating Napoleon. It has to be British. And I think it's a real shame because, yeah, Leipzig is such a masterclass in them understanding that we need to not fight him. We need to pick off his marshals. We need to find ways around him. We need to not confront him directly. I also would love to have seen more Blücher because the guy they have playing Blücher, I think for the 5 seconds he's on screen, he looks an absolute dead ringer. And I would love to have seen more of that. But again, if we want to focus on Napoleon, we want to focus on him being this character assassination again, we're going to keep going on this thread. Let's show him not understanding. Let's show him throwing a strop. Really have him like, how have they done this? They're not meant to beat me. I'm meant to win. Have him really not like it. And particularly again in the retreat from Leipzig, he abandons the army. He straight up just leaves. He goes, well, we've lost this. I'm off back to France. We don't get that. We don't get him going, not worth it. Not worth my time. I'm off now.
And again, I mentioned Bernadotte earlier, and he's such a vital part of Scandinavian history as well. So I was really let down. It should have been, and again, it's there's a lot of characters that you need in a movie too, and they have enough already. But it should have been a great rivalry for Napoleon to have, because they didn't really get along that well, him and Bernadotte, and he marries off Desiree to him just because he marries Josephine. And kind of like we talked about again, as we talked about in the like episode 3-part episode on Napoleon, they were kind of just okay, you can have her, just take her, and that would didn't have to be there. But if Bernadotte had been in the movie, it could have been a great rivalry between them. And then we see Bernadotte defeat him because it's his idea that they use Napoleon's own tactic against him, and he become later the king of Sweden, Norway, and in the Kiel Treaty that signs Norway over to Sweden for until 1905, and it. And that would have been that's just a gentleman fun fact, but he's also his dynasty is still ruling Sweden today, so he's obviously a vital part of Scandinavian history, and it's also important in French history as well. And then under Napoleon, I believe most French look at him as a traitor today, but still, he's undeniably an important part of the Napoleon era. So not having Bernadotte in there, I think, was a missed opportunity. And also as a Scandinavian, I would have been a bit
Yeah.
fanboying if I saw him myself,
No, of
because I have
course.
such a great respect for him.
I think it particularly comes down to, and I don't want to keep using other films as a frame reference, but we look at the death of Stalin. At the end of the film, we get, we get the that clip of the Russian government, and we get, well, here's the new Soviet premier, and then we get over his shoulder, here's the next guy. Here's the guy who comes in afterwards. And we get this suggestion that this actually hasn't ended at all. And because we've got, again, Josephine and Napoleon, Josephine in general, we've got two different sort of sides of this film. If it was just Napoleon the general, I think absolutely it would have been amazing to see more of that because being able to play them off. I mean, I've said to people before, and I will maintain this, Bernadotte is the real winner of the entire period. He starts off as the son of a carpenter or whatever and dies the king of Sweden. That's it. He's won. There is
That's
nobody
like
else.
that, as I would say, that he's kind of the Hamilton of Europe. I mean, he came from nothing and he had like everything.
He absolutely is the definition of a winner of the Game of Thrones of the Napoleonic period. He is an incredible, interesting guy. And yeah, it's a shame that we don't get this amazing thing of Napoleon's life. He dies in exile, but this guy right next to him got to die as King of Sweden, and that would have been a really nice moment to show. And I completely agree. This is again an Anglo-centric history. We don't get anything else. I think if this was written by someone from Sweden, this very much gets played like Napoleon and Bernadotte are almost two sides of the same coin in some ways.
They're kind of odd, though. They really are, I think. But
Yeah.
we have to talk about, of course, before getting to what it's like 5 second scene of Elba. And I want to talk a little bit about Elba before we move into Waterloo, because Napoleon and Elba is, and again, is a fascinating thing itself, because he actually genuinely tries to do good in Elba. He gets that kind of sum from the French government that he can work with, and they genuinely try to improve Elba as a city and as an island, and And in the end, one of the reasons I think why he chooses to return is because he doesn't get enough funding for what he wants to do, how he wants to improve Elba as an island. And he generally tries to do quite well of on Elba. Doesn't just completely give up on the island. We see like the silly scene where he just sits on the island for 3 minutes, and then he's quite a long time in Elba as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I Elba is a period that I think that whole I think when they were writing this film together, they must have known that any film depiction of the abdication was going to be compared to Rod Steiger in Waterloo, because that scene is just incredible. I think they knew that that whole bit of his life was going to be compared, because what we get in Waterloo is he abdicates and then it's him on a boat coming back. And I think they probably were being led by that, because they knew that anything they were going to do was going to be broadly linked to that. And we get this amazing, again, him turning up with the army, which is nice, because people don't realize that he gets sent into exile with a private routine of 1,000 men, which is, that's not a private army, that's an actual army. That's just, he's given a regiment. But again, it's his understanding that they acknowledge that he wants to be maintained. And again, have him throw a fit. Have him be this awful, petulant child and go, "I want men. I want troops with me. I want more of them." Because yeah, his exile in Elba is seemingly quite an interesting period that people don't really talk about. And he only really escapes because his jailer goes to a party in Italy, which, if I was invited to a party in Naples, I'd probably go to that instead.
I mean, so let's talk about this return. And again, I want to refer to my third part in Napoleon. We talked about this when you meet the troops on his way. And you don't really get to show the 100 days either that is famous for after the return of it, because that is an entirely different man from pre-Elba Napoleon. And
Absolutely.
again, we spoke about this. I want to refer to Alexander Mikhail Berdyaev. I'm sorry if I say this name wrong. If you're listening to this episode, I'm sorry if I said it wrong. But we spoke about this. We didn't really feel why the troops were, when he met the troops, we didn't really feel why they were joining him. Why did they choose not to arrest him immediately? And he just said, "Do you recognize me?" And yes, Emperor. And he doesn't make some fabulous speech about, "Oh, you should join your old master," and blah, 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 and et cetera, and then join him, and everyone is just happy, and "Yes, we are with you, Emperor."
I mean, it's interesting. I was saying earlier about the idea that he doesn't really come across as very charismatic. A friend of mine, Graham Callister, shout out to Graham, he's a lecturer at York St John's. He's a lovely guy. He's done a lot of research as part of his new his current project, looking at the registers of the regiments because at Waterloo. So he's got a full demographic breakdown of d'Erlon's corps. He's also got a breakdown of the fifth line and the battalion that meets Napoleon that day. And from looking at their enlistment records, when Napoleon says, "Do you recognize me?" from Graham's own words, the honest answer for most would have been no. They'd never served with or near him. They would have seen 1,000 portraits, busts, medals, coins. He'd have been talked about constantly, but they wouldn't have met him. And so when they break ranks and join him, it's basically because their Colonel Lessard, doesn't stop them. So it's not, and that is because of charisma. Napoleon was a charismatic guy who'd created this culture
And again,
of,
I didn't. That's one of the reasons I didn't buy
yeah.
Joaquin Phoenix as Napoleon. I didn't feel the charisma that it came when he met the troops, for example. That's one example. I
Exactly. Like
didn't feel
these
that.
men joining the army would have entered a cult that completely fostered loyalty to him. And I just don't buy it at any point. He doesn't come across charismatic. I mean, it's also the fact that we're led to believe that he's also coming back because Josephine's ill. Like, that's how we're told he comes back. He comes back
And
because
again, that's what we are
Josephine is
told
dying.
in Egypt as well. Because that's one of that you said, because it's a hard dog for Josephine, because that's why he runs off from Egypt. But it's that's really not
I
the
just
case
don't
at
buy
all.
any of it. And particularly, it's also another weird nod to the British comedy scene is that Kevin Eldon's playing her doctor. And Kevin Eldon is best known for most people from a 3-minute clip he's in the IT Crowd playing a bad guy with a bad French accent. Like, it's very odd seeing all these various people in these roles where we're led to believe this is a very intense moment. And I'm going, why is Kevin Eldon in this? It's a very odd. And then, yeah, Waterloo in and of itself is just, yeah. Do we have to go through it?
3 seconds. I want to talk about the 100 days before, because again, I did like the brief cameo of Louis XVIII. That was kind of
Yeah.
nice to see. But this, like I said, that's I want to talk a little bit about the 100 days of his famous Napoleonic rules, because that's kind of, he wasn't the same person that he was before. So I want to talk, before we go into Waterloo, I want to talk about 100 days a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, particularly the 100 Days. Ian McNeice is a really great casting decision, actually, for Louis XVIII, because I think he's visually got the impression down to a T. But again, I think we're sort of missing, if we want to show him as this character assassination, this awful tyrant person, people were still loyal to him. And they absolutely were. I mean, the fact that Ney point blank changes sides, having just been serving in the French royalist government.
It's interesting again that we see Fouché actually coming back to Napoleon's government as well. This would have been a cool little scene when we see first Fouché swearing loyalty to. That would have been cool to see that Fouché was swearing loyalty to Louis XVIII, and then he does when Napoleon returned. We should have seen, for example, Fouché swearing loyalty back to Napoleon again.
And also, and again, following into this thread, we also see large numbers of, and from Graham's research into Delon's corps, a lot of men do also volunteer again. So they've been discharged. A lot of them come back. So whether we can say, oh, Napoleon was an awful, awful person, or maybe he was an awful ruler or not, and clearly some in France were very tired and some did not come back, a lot still did. He was a charismatic guy. And we don't really get a sense of mustering the armies, of scrambling to get men in uniform, when actually they absolutely were, because they had the numbers to justify it. Conscription gets back brought back in, but it doesn't really need to be. There's not a lot produced by it, insofar as the volunteering movement really produces a lot of men. And we just don't get the sense that this is it. We know from, our own history that this is the end. It's one last hurrah and then he's gone. They didn't know that. And we sort of miss that conversation about no, we need to mobilize. Particularly the film Waterloo does get this right, where you've got Rod Steiger going on, we need to mobilize, we'll train the recruits, we'll get moving, we'll challenge them there. We get a sense of urgency. We just don't get that from Napoleon.
Something that needs to be pointed out as well, and we discussed this in part three as well, is that, remember most of the pe original people, and there was a word line when before the battle that to say men of Austerlitz, and it kind of w struck a bit weird to me, because most people died on the Moscow campaign. Most people from Austerlitz are the OG gang from the original Napoleon's army, the Grand Army. They died on the Moscow campaign, so most people
Absolutely.
got recruited into the Waterloo were not very, what's the word? They weren't experienced soldiers. They were fresh, so to speak. A lot of them didn't have any battle experience, and that's partly one of the reasons as well that they didn't have the veterans from his earlier campaign. And very few, in fact, did, I believe, were actually from his early campaign. There were 90%. 80-90% something were new recruits. So it's most of the people were inexperienced soldiers, and that's, like I said, that's one of the reasons he lost Waterloo in the first place.
I mean, certainly the evidence that we've had, and certainly the work that Graham's done, is very impressive. I'm looking forward to it coming out at some point. They were by no means all completely raw conscripts, but they still were certainly new soldiers. And I think that definitely has, being able to have him come back and go, I don't recognize any of you, would have been really nice, particularly the Imperial Guard. Most of the old guard at Waterloo
And that's why,
are
as
not the
in
old
that
guard.
line struck a bit weird to me. Heroes of awesome. No, most of them are dead, probably.
Yeah, I mean, again, would have been really, but equally, I get him trying to, psych them up. But I think it would be really nice to have him go, I don't recognize any of you, because, and having that moment of realizing that, oh, yeah, maybe I'm in the wrong. I mean, there's a comment he makes at the very end of the film where it's him going, oh, this is my version of the story. I'm hoping everyone hears my version. Why is his version so nasty about it? If this is his version, why is he awful in it? Have him, if you're going to have this be his version, I want to see that moment where he realizes, oh, yeah, maybe this was a bad thing. Maybe I didn't do what I wanted to do. I would say, maybe he never thought that. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not enough of an expert on him as personally, but I think it'd be certainly. There's room again for more nuance, more discussion that wouldn't have changed the viewing experience for a non-expert, but I think would have made it a much more rich experience for those who do know a bit more about it. I mean, yeah, Waterloo's got the same problem, to be honest. Do we have to talk about it?
I've read a little bit, yeah, a little bit. If you don't mind, I want to ask, what do you think about the scene where Rowan has the, I think supposedly has him in eye shot when the sniper, supposed sniper scene. What about
Oh,
that?
that shot is such a, it's such a, I remember actually laughing in the cinema, and there were a couple of guys next to me, I found out later, were also, hobby nerds, and similarly were chuckling. I don't even know what to make of any of that. I mean, so that
What about
actually
the
is one of the,
trenches? What about the trenches?
yeah, I don't know if what's
Yeah,
even, I don't know what's funnier, the trenches or the fact that they leave them to form square. It's a very weird decision on the whole thing. I mean, particularly looking at that Baker rifle, for instance, that incident is taken from a real account. I think it's Mercer's battery, where they ask Wellington, "Can we please fire a shot?" And these are like 12-pounders. These have got a range of a mile and a half. A Baker rifle does not have that range. It's such a stupid thing. But I think the fact that he felt that was appropriate. You watch the scene. It's not a big field. Waterloo is a massive battlefield by some standards. It's not the biggest ever, but it's still like a mile and a half wide. It's a big battlefield for one person. And the film version, we saw it's like 20 guys in on a slope, basically. It's a very weird scene because you've got this incredible build up to this moment, and you've got this wonderful bit where Napoleon's trudging through the mud and looking across his field. We see Wellington's version, and you've got a guy with a telescope going, "Yes, I can see him and I can hit him from here." So, yeah, I'm not a massive fan of any of that, quite frankly. I mean, again, we also come back to this Anglocentric. There are no Dutch or Germans, there are no Belgians. We just have redcoats, hordes of redcoats, apparently, all in these trenches that look weird. And the whole thing, I think, as a result, it just comes across. Not, it's not even, "Oh, you weren't there, you didn't do your research." Any map of the battlefield would have told you that was nonsense. I get you focusing on one bit of the battlefield. Go and do La Haye Sainte, go and do Hougoumont. I get wanting to do just one thing, or just do d'Erlon's corps advance that gets repelled and countercharged. Just do the British cavalry charges that sweeps down. But the fact that they tried to do all of it and didn't really do any of it well. I mean, the funniest bit for me, I think, is generally the funniest bit, was when the Prussians arrived from the west, which is genuinely hilarious. And I don't know, they could have mirror flipped that and it would have been fine. But someone at some point looked at a map of Waterloo and said, "Yes, those Prussians that are in the east of Waterloo, they arrived from the west. They apparently double timed it around the entire battlefield and arrived from Wellington's right."
Something else I thought about, and to do a Game of Thrones comparison with the Battle of Winterfell, it should have been like that moment in cinema where you see almost feel like the Napoleon's losing, and then you have the Prussians coming in and being the hero of the day. But at the end, like you said, it's British, so they have to be the heroes. But at the end, the Prussians should have been kind of like the hero, like the little finger when he comes in with the army. And the saves the day in the end. It should have been kind of like the Winterfell scene, where
Or
the Prussian
the Battle of
actually
Pelennor
saves.
Fields in
Yeah,
Lord of the
yeah,
Rings,
yeah.
in The Return of the King, when Rohan
Yeah,
show up.
yeah, yeah. It should have been
Yeah.
that moment. It should have been at a great moment where they, the British actually needed help,
Yeah, I think
and
unfortunately, not unfortunately, one, yeah, it spoils the story that the British were the best, but also in a very basic sense, it's the Prussians were there for most of the day. They were doing their job most of the day. It's quite a complicated narrative that gets spun out anyway, which I'm not going to look just at Sharp, but for all of this film's faults, it does show the Prussians being there, which is better than a lot of other things I've seen. So we've got to give it a win for at least having them be present. So is what it is.
But I want to was mentioning inexperience of the French soldiers, but what about the British soldiers? How experienced were they in battle? Were they equally inexperienced as the new French recruits were, or how experienced were these veterans as well?
That was a really interesting question. I mean, particularly the British army that is there is a bit of a composite. A good chunk of them are peninsula veterans who, between the peninsula finishing in 1814, either get sent back to Britain and then get sent on straight on to the Netherlands and the Low Countries when Napoleon returns, or are sent straight there anyway for garrison duty. There are some newer regiments. There's one battalion of the 14th, which are all under 25, from one account I found. So they're all quite new. The Dutch soldiers are again a bit of a medley. A lot of the Dutch and the German soldiers had battle experience, some of them on the French side. There's a really famous incident at Quatre Bras, which again gets missed, obviously, where I think it's Dutch and Nassauers spend about half an hour shooting at each other before realizing they're on the same side because they all see blue and hear French and start opening fire. So the Allied army that's there under Wellington is a mixture of quite experienced and quite new. The Prussian army under Blücher are all very experienced troops, particularly the Landwehr and the infantry. When they enter Plancenoir, the accounts we get of that fighting are very much not nice. The Prussians are very clear there's no prisoners. And when they burst into the French right, the French descriptions of the fighting that goes on are very unpleasant because the Prussians at that point are very much done with the French. They'd suffered a humiliating defeat 2 days before and they were not in the mood to be kind.
So we have to just of the scene where Wellington beat Napoleon, because again, that's one other thing that never happened as well.
Yeah. I don't even know what to make of it because I think Rupert Everett is a really great actor. I feel like he was like with a too old for the part. Too old for the part, but also more than that, I think Rupert Everett was clearly given direction to be the most arrogant snob possible in as little time, which is not a bad version of events. It's just done someone that's unfortunately not really grounded. I
Also,
think it's a very.
another thing I want to point out, things that weren't, sorry for interrupting you,
No, of course.
but another thing that would have been cool to see would have been a cameo of Nelson, who also were rightful
Yeah.
to Napoleonic era. So we, and he and again, if you're going to show the British as heroes, Nelson would have been a great example to set.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a really great series of books I've got on my shelf downstairs by Simon Scarrow, which is a quartet about Napoleon and Wellington, because they were born a couple months apart and it plays them off as equivalent, different parts in their career at the same time. And he invents a scene where Nelson meets Wellington, which was actually possible because they were in
You
London
mean
about the same
Napoleon
time.
meets
No.
Wellington?
So Nelson meets Wellington because
All
they were
right.
in London at the same time. And the scene is therefore technically feasible. Like it's not the best thing in the world. We don't know if it happened, but it's a cool idea that a very junior Wellington meets a very senior Nelson is like, oh, you're like the national hero. This wonderful moment we get.
There's a funny scene in
Welling.
Master and Commander where I don't
Yeah.
remember his name, with the Padre Passman assault.
Absolutely. And that's a
Yeah.
really nice moment. We have no reason for Wellington and Nelson, Wellington and Napoleon to meet. No reason at all. It doesn't serve the plot other than to, I guess, remind Napoleon that he's not rich. It's a very weird scene because Rupert Everett is playing a very aristocratic, very snobbish Wellington, who seemingly just shows up and is told that this midshipman like laughing at Napoleon. And again, if we're thinking about screen time, oh, it's such a big film. Why is it there?
Yeah.
It's there because David Scarpa felt that they had to meet because they're the great big adversaries of the age. The fact is, Napoleon really wasn't that bothered about Wellington. He didn't really understand why his generals kept being beaten by him. There's that really famous incident at the moment he says to Soult, like, why are you scared of him? He's just a random British guy. And I think that's a real shame that, again, we get this Anglocentric narrative that overrides everything else. That becomes the story, even though it's just not factually true.
Let's talk about the last thing, and that is the death. So ridiculous death, comic death of Napoleon on Saint-Helena in England. Attempt at making a comical death of him when he sits at a table and he just falls down.
Yeah, I guess that's meant to be a metaphor. I don't mind it so much. I mean, they at least didn't go down the British were poisoning him route, which is such an often touted. So, if you weren't aware, the cult Napoleon, because Napoleon what the arsenic. So, because the wallpaper at the time did have arsenic in it, the suggestion is the British were poisoning him. Which one, everyone was exposed to it. That wasn't new. Secondly, the description of his post-mortem makes it reasonably certain that Napoleon died of bowel or stomach cancer, which is not a nice death, I should say, as well, and does explain his earlier ex his symptoms, particularly one of the ones at Waterloo. So I get wanting to have it wrap up in a moment where he's just sort of passing out and we get this metaphorical end to his life. I think it's a nice moment. And again, I think would have a lot more weight if him going, this was my story, was actually his story. This is a story written by Englishmen, and it's a real shame that his
Yeah.
dying moment of tell my message. His message is he was an awful person, which if you're writing your own story, you tend to not be the antagonist.
So, I think just what is your overall thoughts on the movie in itself?
I think my overall thoughts, I wanted to say this a bit earlier, but I'm going to say it now, that the historians, for the most part, and me included, don't mind something not being accurate completely. Like, fully
I
accurate
mean,
isn't actually a
Braveheart, for
problem.
example.
Well, yeah, there's a line on that. That definitely frustrates me.
That's an episode in itself.
Yeah, definitely. But there's definitely a line of, I don't mind things being inaccurate. What I mind is things being internally inconsistent. They need to feel real. Like, does this world feel like these are real people who actually live in it? So there's a TV show called The Great, which I probably
Yeah,
recommend, made by Hulu. That
brilliant.
feels real. It's ridiculous. It's very much not historical, but it makes it very clear from the beginning, this is not historical. This is not real. This is a bit of a laugh. And it works in that context. Same with A Knight's Tale. The Favourite is another one. It's about a really complicated romantic relationship. It's very difficult to follow in places, but it feels lived in. There is a real dedication to making this world feel real.
And
And
yeah,
we can
again, I
we
think the BBC drama, as I mentioned earlier, War and Peace is an excellent
absolutely.
example
I
as
think, again, it
well.
feels like these are actual real people who really exist and really live in this
I mean,
world.
it's Tolstoy as well, so it's a given.
Absolutely. And I think this film, for all of it, there's some nice bits in it, and the uniforms, as I say, are actually very good. Some of the action shots, I mean, particularly Austerlitz, is gorgeous to watch. It's very impressively visually constructed. And we even get like a Frenchman in the film. He plays a Corsican, but he's French. And we get some nice casting. But I think, unfortunately, they got hooked on this weird Josephine femme fatale dynamic with her and Napoleon. They wanted to make a big battle thing, and they sort of got stuck between them. And actually, this film would have greatly benefited from being either a romantic thing or a battle thing, but
Yeah.
not both. I mean, The Favourite doesn't have features with Queen Anne. We get the Marlborough War. We don't see any battles, and it still feels grounded and real. And this film, there's some nice, accurate moments in it, but even the inaccurate stuff doesn't pass muster because it's not entertaining. It just doesn't feel grounded and real, and doesn't feel like a coherent story in a way that someone who doesn't know the period can understand. And I know plenty of people who are not experts in this period who came to me afterwards and said, I didn't actually really get it, what was happening.
Yeah.
And that's the key, is that if a non-expert doesn't get it either, I think you've not really done what you wanted to do. And particularly, I think Ridley Scott and David Scarper clearly wanted such a spectacle. They chose romance and spectacle and sort of forgot to connect the dots a bit.
Yeah. It's funny to me that the one Napoleon movie that isn't even about Napoleon, Master and Commander, still is a supreme Napoleon movie. And the details in the movie, so I don't know if you follow a channel called History Buff where he reviewed
Yes.
that movie, and as he said, the details that they managed to cramp in on that little boat for considering it's a fictional story, but it's still
Absolutely. But even this.
incredibly historical accurate. Like we mentioned, the scene where he said, talk about meeting Nelson, it's also adds funny bits to it's
Absolutely.
actually funny. Now, Napoleon tried to be funny as he, but it failed completely, and Master and Commander just. It's an incredible film that's, even though it's fictional story, maybe not accurate to the book, but still, it's just the supreme Napoleon movie.
But I think that's the key, is that the Master and Commander books, I have yet to read them because every time I try and get near them, I have to find the Naval Dictionary. There is an incredible amount of accuracy there, but it's so dense, it's very difficult. And that's where the line often gets drawn with accurate means bad. I don't think that's true. Master and Commander demonstrates that you can have an accurate film. It's not perfectly accurate, but the stuff that's not fully accurate still feels authentic. It still feels true to the period. And
For
that's where this
example,
film really struggles.
one thing that springs to my mind is the scene when I don't think it was a commander, lieutenant or something, when the crews begin singing in the boat and the commander joins in, and everyone is like staring at him, why did he join in for anyone? And again, this is from the History of Channel, we mentioned this, so I don't give him credit for this. But this wasn't common that the officers, they wouldn't join in the regiment, so that's kind of why they looked at him that way when they started singing and he joined in for the fun. It wasn't, and probably I don't know if it still is true for modern day armies or navies, but that's all the little details that add from the surgeon to everything, how they repair the ship, how it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, say the costumes are by no means completely faultless, but the fact that they feel real. Like this feels like stuff people actually wear, but it looks for the most part lived in. I think that really is the key, that this world does not feel grounded in a way that I can understand it. You know, these people don't, I don't sympathize for them. I don't really like anyone in it. Josephine, I guess, is likable up to a point, but Napoleon is basically just a bit of a, can't
Yeah.
swear.
Not so much for feeling sorry for him or like, oh, he was, don't come across emotionally attached to any of the characters.
Yeah, he doesn't come across as a charismatic leader of men. He comes across as a petulant child the entire way through. That's the real, and
And
that's
a
clearly what the
scene, just
intention was.
horrible scene when he just drowns like a dog and just, I have the most beautiful wife.
Yeah, I think that's the real problem is that yeah, that they set out to make a film that the protagonist isn't really likable in,
Yeah.
which is difficult anyway.
I
So
mean,
yeah, I think
this
that's
is
my
not at
final.
all, this might not be a good comparison, but to do I need to support a solid comparison, but Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David is another likable, he's playing a not very nice person, and he's not a, kind of a douche in the series, but he's still able to be somewhat likable in a sense. He's not
Yeah.
supposed to be the nice, I wouldn't say he's the nice guy in the series, but he still managed to come to sympathize with him still with Napoleon. And this is probably a stupid comparison, but it with Napoleon, I didn't sympathize with him at all. I didn't feel the character.
Absolutely. And that's possibly me. So my official verdict as a historian, I think probably would be not angry, just disappointed. There was a great opportunity here, and it's just a shame it wasn't done.
We should really do one episode at some point. Everything is right with Master and Commander at some point.
Oh, I've got a much longer list than I wrote the notes for this on that film. Oh.
maybe one day if this one goes well. And I think we're gonna round it up there. And I hope you enjoyed this. We've almost been at it for 2 hours on
Yes.
this run, so I think it's time to round it up there. We should probably should split this in 2 parts, but it is what it is. So before you go, do you have anything you want to promote or anything, any social media, any books maybe you want to share, or any where can people find you if they have further questions about the movie or the era of the 18th, 19th, early 19th century?
Now, of course, so I'm doing my PhD at the University of Leeds, and while I'm doing that, I'm working on a book for the Army Record Society, which will be coming out in a couple of years' time. I'll probably be promoting that when it comes around to it. But you can find me on the platform formerly known as Twitter, at RMB underscore history. I'm on Blue Sky as well under that same name. And you can also follow along there with my thesis more generally. I'm looking at home defense in the 1790s in Britain. So not quite Napoleon, but Napoleon adjacent. And yeah, that's what I'm working at the moment. I'm appearing at a couple of conferences. I'm going to be speaking at the Waterloo Association study day in September in York, in Leeds, Leeds, sorry, I should know that. And I'm also speaking at a conference in June at Lancaster. Other than that, wait for the thesis, really. I'm working on it at the moment. It's coming out at some point when I finish it.
I'm looking forward to it. This has been With That Aged Well. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you're on Spotify, consider giving us 5 stars. That would help us out a lot. If you're on the Apple Podcasts, consider write a review. If I see it, I will try to read it on this podcast as well. And if you're on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. My name is Adam. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a great pleasure. And I will see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.